Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was recorded on Monday, June 27, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Today we'll be discussing the Supreme Court's rulings this morning in Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt and McDonnell v. United States, as well as a few other thoughts on the now-concluded term. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome experts Roger Severino and Greg Katsas. More complete bios were provided to you in the email notice of the call, so I'll stop here to reserve more times for their presentations and your questions. We're going to be dividing our time today roughly half and half between Hellerstedt and McDonnell and other points on the term. So I'm going to turn things over here to Roger Severino for his presentation of about 15 minutes. At the end of that, we'll take questions on the abortion case until 2:30, and then we'll move to Greg Katsas and talk about McDonnell v. United States. So with that, Roger, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. This was one of the blockbuster decisions of this highly unusual term. The bottom line was this was a 5-3 decision that was reversing the Fifth Circuit decision and striking down Texas's abortion clinic safety regulations. The safety regulations are surgical standards. They're called ambulatory surgical center standards, which would have required abortion clinics to meet standards that ambulatory surgical centers generally follow, and this generally covers invasive surgery, so think colonoscopy, plastic surgery, things that aren't necessarily requiring hospitalization, but do require a higher standard because of the risk of things like infection, et cetera. And it includes a lot of common sense provisions, such as widths in hallways have to be a certain width in order to allow a gurney to go through in case of emergency. Standards for safety, including fire protection, nurse certification, the number of soap dispensers, all sorts of things to a filtration of the air system to make sure that infection is low and that safety protocols are kept so that if something does go wrong in an abortion, which they do go wrong, there will be actual help for the women involved so that any mishap will be limited in terms of its danger to the health and safety of women. Already we see that 200 women are hospitalized in Texas every year due to complications after abortions, and there was an amicus brief submitted by 3,300 women who had suffered physical harm, psychological harm, trauma because of abortions that go wrong. The argument made by the state of Texas is that this is not like a tooth cleaning. This is an actual invasive surgery, and if you think about what actually goes on in abortion, early or late term, you're entering into a place that normally you do not enter unless you have a very good reason, sterilization with any instrument when you're involved with medical procedures. Another element of HB 2, which was a Texas law, had to do with doctors having admitting privileges in nearby hospitals within 30 miles. And that's to guarantee continuity of care such that if something does go wrong, then the doctor will be able to hand the file over straight from the patient from one facility to another seamlessly to have that continuity of care so that the women's health results are improved. Those are the interests involved from the state of Texas's point of view. That's what they argued. And interestingly, the intent of these laws was not questioned by the majority. Even though laws were struck down, this was written by Justice Breyer, and he signaled at oral argument that he was not going to question the motivation of the state of Texas. Justice Breyer said, it looks like they're trying to act in furtherance of women's health, and that's good enough for me. And the question then turned as to whether or not that law was actually going to be effective or pose an undue burden to a woman's access to abortion. Only one person wrote otherwise, and that was Justice Ginsburg in a separate concurrence that she wrote alone, where she, it was a short piece, but she effectively said that she questioned Texas's motivation as to why it was passing these laws, suggesting it was designed to limit abortion access and not further women's health. But But again, that was only one vote, whereas the majority went along and said, didn't mention anything about the actual motivation behind these laws. So there is a silver lining there in that, at least on the undue burden prong, when it's related to purpose, if it's an illegitimate purpose, that was not one of the bases used to strike down the laws. The basis was the effects, and it did it in an interesting way. So the Texas argued that the Casey undue burden test had really two parts. One was a rational basis component, meaning so long as there's a legitimate basis supporting the law, in this case, the increased health and safety of women, then you get past the purpose prong, and then you go straight to the effects. And then the question is whether there is an actual undue burden regardless of the intent of the state acting. So once you're past the intent portion, it's rational basis, then you go into the undue burden test, which by itself is kind of hazy. What is an undue burden? Scalia was very adamant in saying that undue burden means whatever five justices of the Supreme Court say, because it's a contentless standard. It was fleshed out a bit in the partial birth abortion case, though. Gonzalez versus Carhart said that when there are disputed issues of medical fact when it comes to safety of the abortion procedures, then legislatures would be able to get deference under those circumstances. With this new decision, and Heller said, the court effectively undoes that holding that preceded it. So it really modifies the Casey test. The amount of deference that was being given to legislatures has really been scaled back by this decision. It is effectively saying it's a matter for the courts to decide, and the courts will be able to do their own fact-finding and come to their own conclusions about the state of medicine when it comes to abortion. This is a move kind of going back to the early Roe v. Wade days, where the courts were hyperactive in striking down every law and second-guessing everything the states were doing. And by Casey, it had moved away. It had gone away from a strict scrutiny framework and the trimester framework and moved to viability and undue burden and allowed certain restrictions to come in so long as it was a legitimate health and safety. And also the interest of human life was also put up to the forefront. Another note to keep in mind is that this case really didn't mention much of anything about the unborn human life that is lost in every abortion. That was one of the main interests that led the court to move away from the Roe v. Wade strict scrutiny framework and towards Casey, but that wasn't mentioned at all, and that silence is at least noteworthy. Now, the actual law at issue dealt with clinic regulations, but people should remember that HB2 also included a 20-week abortion ban, which was not challenged, which would have touched on the life issues and the value of life. So this was focused pretty squarely on just the health and safety issue of the side of the equation when it comes to Casey. Justice Thomas, in dissent, and when you're reading these opinions, they are quite long, and I would recommend you start with Justice Thomas's opinion in dissent. It's shorter, it gets to the heart of the matter, and then you'll be able to see go through the thickness of the majority opinion, which is 43 pages, with a better perspective. You'll be able to get the highlights better. So that's my tip on going through these opinions. So the main nub of the whole case turned on whether these health and safety regulations did enough such that it would justify any burdening on abortion access. That's how the court reconceptualized Casey, which is a move away from what Texas was arguing and what effectively Casey said and what the dissents say. The dissents say so long as you get past the hurdle of the health interests, then the question as to the burden is standalone. It's a standalone question. What is the effect on women? And you don't go and create a balancing test to weigh the governmental interest compared to the amount of the burden. But that's precisely what the court did. So undue burden now means, contrary to Casey and Gonzalez, it now means it is a balancing test. So whenever a state moves to further the health and safety of women undergoing abortions, whatever negative consequences that has to clinic access is now put on the scales. Unfortunately, there was very little guidance as to how you calibrate those scales at all. It was a grab bag of facts related to this particular case that the court pointed to. It would point to things like a percentage increase in the number of women who would drive farther than 150 miles to reach a local clinic, or 200 miles, or 250 miles, and each percentage increase. And then threw out some static numbers. This is the number of thousands of women who would be impacted. So things of these sorts were put forward. And then on the other side of the equation, the balance was trying to gauge how medically effective these regulations were going to be, combined to predicting the number of clinics that would be closed because of these regulations. So it's very difficult ex ante for any state government to come up with these figures and to have a really good sense of what any health and safety regulation impact will be. It puts state legislatures in a terrible bind because they have to look through a crystal ball because the court has taken away their deference, and it would require tremendous fact-finding by a state legislature to put forward enough facts saying these are precisely the number of women, perhaps, that would be saved from these type of complications in this number, in this effect, whereas you can't use common sense. If you have sterile environments that are much more sterile than before, you would expect there'd be less infections. So the court has taken away that discretion to make those sorts of judgments and threw that discretion onto the lap of the courts. So now the courts get to use their common sense judgment. And in fact, the Supreme Court used the phrase common sense. It's common sense that we would expect a lot of clinics to close. It's common sense that we would expect that existing clinics would not be able to take on the additional business from the clinics that did close. It's common sense to think that this expensive clinics are expensive to open and clinics would not open. So the courts now get to use their common sense, but the legislatures cannot. And I think it inverts the process that was there before this decision and really puts the states in a difficult position to get through these new hurdles that they didn't face before. Doesn't mean they can't do it. Doesn't mean they shouldn't attempt it. But it becomes much more difficult. And then the question arises, what if you get a friendly district court judge and finds opposite facts and says these do help health and safety as women, and I credit this expert and I discredit the abortion clinic experts. What happens in those circumstances? Is now a reviewing court going to revisit the issue based on Hellerstedt? It's hard to say because the court here gave deference to the district court. And if it's a district court's judgment call, a district court could go the other way. And it would be hard for the Supreme Court to say, no, you got it wrong, but this court got it correctly. And this brings up Justice Thomas's point. He says, effectively, the Supreme Court is now turning into a medical review board for the entire country when it comes to abortion and only abortion. Because it doesn't get into these questions to what is medically effective, how many women are going to be hurt possibly or not. Yet it did credit the district court saying, effectively, these regulations don't do much at all to further women's health. And that's rather striking to go that far, to really say it doesn't do much at all. And I think the district court said it doesn't do anything in additional in terms of health and safety. And that's really a strong statement to make. And I'm surprised to see the Supreme Court go that far to credit one district court judge based on the testimony mostly of one expert who made some of these findings. Some interesting things you should keep in mind. A lot of the discussion focused early on at oral argument and Justice Alito's dissenting opinion on res judicata and claim preclusion. There's a whole lot of discussion about whether or not the facial challenges were preserved properly or not. There was a first round of litigation where a facial challenge was dismissed, and they sued again, many of the same parties, and didn't raise it the second time around. And they did not petition for cert the first time around, yet the Supreme Court snatched it up and said, yes, we will allow you to do a facial challenge. Again, you get a second bite of the apple. And this is going to wreak havoc on civil procedure. Normally, you have a sense of finality if you litigate an issue all the way through, especially an issue regarding facial challenges, which presupposes if you win as a state, then you're in the clear, and now you move on to as-applied challenges. But the court is saying no. If facts on the ground are different when you do the as-applied challenge, you could use that to infer a facial challenge and bring that back to life and then strike down a bill or a law in its entirety. And the dissents really went after the majority for taking this very aggressive move, and it is a bit of a exemplar of abortion distortion. So when it comes to abortion cases, the Supreme Court does some very curious things. So here we already have clinics that are suing, not women seeking abortions. So that's already a little unusual, and Justice Thomas mentioned that. This is such a fundamental right recognized in the Constitution. Where are the women suing? Why is it only clinics suing? Yet clinics have the standing to sue. I just mentioned the facial challenge issue and claim preclusion. And then the court did not sever any of the provisions it found offensive. Yet the Texas law had a super-duper severability clause, the most thorough severability clause you will ever see. It said any sentence and any phrase of this law shall be severable independent of the others. Yet the Supreme Court majority said, we're going to treat it as a unified whole. And both laws, the ambulatory surgical center portion and the admitting privileges portion, we're going to treat them both as working in unison and separately, being harmful and undue burdens. And within those laws, you can't peel off any piece. So things related to soap dispensers, sorry, you can't have just that regulation in or width of hallways or one or filtration units or the number of fire extinguishers you could have. None of those could actually be severed and allowed to stand, even though common sense, to use the court's phrase, common sense would tell us that at least some of those regulations would not impact abortion access at all. And in fact, you would think that if you have increased standards, it would improve women's health outcomes, which also is striking why the court would say it probably wouldn't, when Planned Parenthood already meets ASC standards with their mega clinics in Texas and opened 3 new ones. They grew by 50%. They have 9. They do thousands upon thousands of abortions, and they have ambulatory surgical center standards already voluntarily meeting them, which may explain why Planned Parenthood did not sue and was not part of this case, because they're sweeping in all the business of all these clinics, substandard clinics that were closing. So the main question comes down to this. These clinics that are closing, would they not be replaced by Planned Parenthoods or other clinics? And what is the overall impact on women's access, and the court is putting it, compared to the benefit to women's health? And in fact, the law was designed to shut down some clinics, because the background of this was, of course, the Gosnell scandal, and this was the Philadelphia clinic called the House of Horrors, where Kermit Gosnell was doing late-term abortions, killing children born alive, and a woman died because of unsanitary conditions and lack of regulations, and they couldn't fit a gurney through the hallway, and that was one of the reasons she died. The grand jury in that case recommended that the state of Pennsylvania adopt ASC standards. The state of Texas noticed and then went to adopt ASC standards on its own as well. Yet the Supreme Court, the majority just dismissed the Gosnell angle, and saying that had Texas just, or Philadelphia, enforced existing laws, then it wouldn't have been an issue. And that's what Texas has to do here. Instead of passing new regulations, just simply enforce what you have, and the problem is solved. This has very interesting echoes to what Second Amendment supporters argue all the time. They say that existing laws should be enough. If you enforce existing laws, you don't need to add new bans. You don't need to take away people's Second Amendment right. And it'll be very interesting to see if in the next Second Amendment case, we'll see these quotes from Breyer and one made by Ginsburg as well come back to be call them out for hypocrisy if they don't use accept this logic when it comes to Second Amendment rights, but they will accept it when it comes to the issue of abortion. The idea that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, this is a question as to the rare part of it. So Texas wants to make it safe. The question as to legality, of course, that is the central question of the culture wars. The rarity prong, and this is where the court is saying we want abortion to be as openly available as possible, and we are willing to say that these health standards, you could have lower health standards so long as abortion access increases and stays at a high level. You can't have a result of shutting down substandard clinics because that will limit the number of options, and we're going to consider that an undue burden because we're now putting it on the scales, and we say that the health benefits based on fact-finding by one district judge are not adequate to support the limitations of access for women. Therefore, the law is struck down. I think this is a difficult result to justify given the previous holdings of the court, and it makes it difficult for the state to continue to regulate abortion in order for this to further the health and safety in women. And I think I'll just end there and open it up for questions as we still have a bit of time. So thanks for having me on and looking forward to your questions.
Well, thank you, Roger, for your presentation. We'll now open the floor to questions. In a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to ask a question, enter star and then the pound key.
Hey, Will, can I just...
Yes, go ahead. Mr. Katsas, you were saying
something? Oh, yeah, sure. Let me just add 2 points to that excellent presentation based on my personal experiences as a government lawyer. First point is I defended the federal partial birth abortion statute when I was at DOJ, and I can tell you this is a huge shift in Justice Kennedy's approach. The whole issue in that case was what happens when the medical evidence is disputed. He wrote a majority opinion saying the legislature gets to resolve the question, and that built on his dissent in the first state partial birth case, Stenberg, where he wrote a dissent saying when the medical evidence is disputed, a state legislature wins, not a district court judge, which is what Breyer had said in that case. So it's very depressing after 2 opinions where Kennedy says legislatures win, not district judges, in the face of conflicting evidence, that he's completely flipped on that and given the left the fifth vote for the old abortion on demand style review. The second point is just in answer to the question of what happens when district judges disagree. I mean, there's one phenomenon when you defend government programs against constitutional challenges, you have to win every case. The challengers only need to win one case. So, you know, suppose the government wins the first case and gets those favorable district court findings. Well, a different abortion group will bring a different case before a different judge. They'll keep doing that until they get a judge who rules their way, strikes the statute in its entirety, and enters a nationwide or statewide injunction against its enforcement, and that'll be that, which is one of the many problems of keying this to what individual district judges do.
Thank you for that. We do have one question on the line now. I think we might have more had I not spoken and trampled all over the computerized prompt telling people to enter star and then the pound key to get in the questioning queue. So we'll go to this first caller now, and while they're asking that question, I invite you to enter star and then the pound key to ask your question next.
Hi, Roger, Greg, and Garrett Snedeker calling with the James Wilson Institute. How are you guys?
Hey, Garrett. How are you?
Hey, I wanted to ask if you could elaborate a little bit more on Clarence Thomas's, in my opinion, magisterial dissent attacking the constitutionality and the coherency of the years of screw regime that we're operating under. This is an extensive opinion in the Grutter case and how his jurisprudence may have evolved since then.
Okay, you're breaking up, so I missed the last part of your question.
And just how Justice Thomas's jurisprudence may have evolved since his ruling in the Grutter case.
Justice Thomas's. I don't think Justice Thomas's jurisprudence evolved. He's not the evolving type. I think he sticks to principle, and here he said that at least recognize your own precedents, and that's what he spent the bulk of his time in his dissent talking about. That the precedents you laid out, Justice Kennedy, in Casey, are now being abandoned in several ways, and one is the legislative deference is flipped on its head, as Greg just mentioned. And the test has been shifted. You're now doing a balancing test, which didn't exist before. And it's replacing judicial deference for legislative deference. And so he hammered on these points. And then he brought up the point of the abortion distortion several times. And this is a reimagining of the undue burden test, which is, of course, bad to begin with, is what he pointed out. And he's always been firm on that he would revisit the entire abortion jurisprudence if he had his druthers. Unfortunately, he only had 3 votes on his side to revisit the abortion jurisprudence. With the loss of Scalia, it would have been a 5-4 decision, but his loss is being felt here. He would have been another compatriot joining Justice Thomas's separate dissent, I would believe.
Okay, and just in general, his critique on the tiers of scrutiny as an illegitimate form of judicial analysis. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so he goes way back, and he takes us on a historical tour of where the Supreme Court went wrong in its tiered analysis, to the point where these are judicial inventions, judicial creations that are not based in principle. Going back to 1938 and the Caroline Products case. So he walks us through, it's just a historical discourse on how we've moved away from the original understanding of the Constitution and how the imposition of tiers aren't really justifiable through the text of the Constitution, the history of the Constitution. And it's really he's called it a concession to defeat when we move this, is because, I mean, just to pull it plainly, the court is making stuff up, is effectively the point he's trying to make, and this is building upon a base of sand. And when you keep constructing an edifice, eventually it all comes crumbling down because it goes beyond the point of intelligibility. And his point is that we're very far along down this route, and this latest movement from undue burden back to strict scrutiny effectively is more of the same, and it's regrettable.
There was a third decision today, which we're not really going to focus on too much, called Voisin, which is relevant to this discussion. It's a statutory question involving whether someone can lose the right to possess a firearm based on a misdemeanor conviction. And Justice Thomas writes a great dissent saying that the statute at issue can be triggered by recklessness. So you could have someone who is texting while driving and there's an accident and some family member in the car gets hurt as a result. That person loses his Second Amendment rights for life. And he makes the point that this is pretty stark contrast between how the court treats the Second Amendment, which is in the Constitution and for which the majority couldn't even be bothered to address, and how it treats other rights like the right to abortion, which isn't in the Constitution. which has all these made-up protections that Rogers talked about, from waiving res judicata to facial invalidation to everything else.
Well, we do have one more question on the line here. I think we can quickly answer this before we move into a discussion of McDonnell. So let's go to that next caller now.
Hi, this is Jen Habercorn at Politico. I'm wondering if you guys can comment a little bit, looking at there are other lawsuits in lower courts against some of these state abortion regulations, how it's going to impact those cases, and how legislatures might respond when they're considering new abortion regulations in light of the decision today.
I think the first step a legislature should do is do an extensive factual record and do a lot of fact-finding up front and presume it's going to be challenged eventually, probably very quickly. And if you have a strong factual record, then it's a battle of experts, battle of facts, and it's just the playing field has been tilted away from the legislatures to a degree, but not to the point where it doesn't exist. So the legislatures still have the ability to regulate in the health and safety interests of women. I think all the justices agree that the states can further that interest and have an ability and indeed a duty to do so. The question is how much evidence they need to back up each regulation. Abortion seems to be unique now in the level of justification a state has to present in order to protect women. And that's an unusual inversion that it's kind of unexpected to a degree. You would expect that if you consider this a women's rights issue, then when women's health is being furthered, and that's the goal, which the Supreme Court did not contest that was the goal. When that's the goal, you would expect that the court would allow the states freedom of action. And they do have an opening if they do fact-finding on the front end now to a more detailed degree than Texas did, which relied on previous case law. So the mm-hmm. states can adapt, and they will adapt.
Thank you.
All right, so I think in this point of the program, we're going to go ahead and move on to McDonnell v. United States. Mr. Katsas, are you ready to take the floor on
sure.
that?
Sure. Let me just begin with a disclaimer that my firm, Jones Day, represents Governor McDonnell and represented him in this case, so you can take my comments with a grain of salt if you'd like. So this case involves, obviously, the government's public corruption case, federal government's case against former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. He's prosecuted for honest services fraud and extortion under the Hobbs Act and through various preliminary negotiations and agreements. The parties essentially convert those charges into a bribery charge. And the essence of bribery is a quid pro quo exchange, which means that a public official takes something of value in return for, this is the key statutory term, official acts. And that statute is applied by the government to prosecute McDonnell, who took about $175,000 in gifts from a constituent who was promoting a particular dietary supplement called Anatoblock, and who wanted government favors. He wanted Virginia to undertake studies of its medical efficacy in order to facilitate his efforts to get FDA approval for the supplement, and he wanted Virginia to possibly wanted Virginia to cover the supplement in its health plan for state employees. So this guy Williams gives the governor, lavishes all these gifts on him, and in return the governor hosts events, invites him to the governor's mansion for a couple of events, sets up a couple of meetings between Williams and state officials who are responsible for either the studies or the funding or the state health plan. And he asks his subordinate officials to consider an adablock. And that's it. No testimony that he ever pressured those officials, and none of the things that Williams ultimately wanted, the state money or the state studies or the state coverage in the health plan, ever came to fruition. The government prosecutes McDonald nonetheless, and they say none of that matters because he took official acts. They say that one form of official act is simply promoting economic development. They say, well, that's something the governor does in his official capacity, and he's promoting this particular product as part of his effort to promote economic development in Virginia. That's an official act. Another variant on this theory is that the lunches at the executive mansion and the calls to his subordinates and the meetings that he sets up, they themselves are official acts. So even if it were the case that the governor did nothing more than invite the constituent to a lunch at the governor's mansion in return for all of the gifts, on the government's theory, that's a criminal violation. And the court unanimously rejects that theory, throws away the McDonald conviction, and imposes some interesting and potentially significant limits on the concept of official act in the bribery statute. So the statute is somewhat broadly written. It requires action on a question, matter, cause, suit, proceeding, or controversy pending before the official. Court says, well, a bunch of those words like cause or suit or proceeding or controversy look like they don't include things like meetings, and they do refer to some narrow, specific agenda item. The court's phrase, something, according to the Chief Justice, that can be put on an agenda, tracked, and checked off. And then the other phrases that are broader, words like questions or matter, court invokes the canon that general words in a statutory list should be construed by reference to the narrower words. And so they say the first major point is that what's not an official act, meetings, arranging meetings, inviting people to a lunch, making calls to subordinates, none of those in and of themselves can be official acts. And then the related point on what can be official acts, court says, well, the matter has to be circumscribed, and then they define what that means in the context of this case. And they say that the decision of UVA researchers whether or not to study this particular supplement, that's an official act. The decision of grant-making officials in the Commonwealth whether to fund studies like that, that's an official act. And the decision of the Virginia officials who run the health plan whether or not to include this supplement in coverage, they say that's an official act. But they then say, well, did McDonald did McDonnell act on those official acts? And they say, you know, you could support a conviction on the theory that either the defendant exerts pressure or provides advice, but not simply for setting up the meeting. So they say, well, if McDonnell makes the phone call and is effectively pressuring the officials to do the studies or spend the money or include the supplement in the health plan, that's a valid theory. That counts as official action, even though he's not the decision maker. Exerting pressure or giving advice is enough. That would support a criminal conviction. But the problem here is there's no way to know whether the jury rested on that permissible theory or on the government's more unbounded theory that even if there's no pressure and even if there's no advice, right, there's no nod, there's no wink, all the governor was doing was facilitating putting this guy in touch with the government officials and then just leaving it to them to decide whether or not to give Williams what he wanted. Nonetheless, the meeting itself is the official act. And the court says, that's crazy. That can't be right. And so because the jury instructions didn't properly limit the term, the conviction gets thrown, set aside, case gets remanded, and importantly, going forward, the court leaves open the question whether there's enough evidence under the legally proper narrower theory in order for the case to go forward. And then they say if the courts decide that there is enough evidence to support that narrower theory, then the government can re-prosecute under a narrower theory and under proper instructions. The rationale is pretty interesting. The major part of this court's analysis is that there have to be meaningful limits on public corruption statutes, in particular bribery, right? It's quid pro quo is the essence of bribery. If you think about it, the quid is what the government official accepts from constituents, and that is everything from campaign contributions to lunch. The quo under the government's theory is everything that public officials do, from arranging meetings to inviting people to an event. That's a ubiquitous quid and a ubiquitous quo, and then the only thing standing behind between public officials and criminal liability for bribery is the pro, the conclusion that the meeting was done in exchange for the gift or the lunch or the contribution. And the government never really had any answer to the point that that's not really a limitation at all. Juries can always infer the pro, and the court gives a couple of examples. It says, well, if a union official wants to approach the government in order to talk about closure of a plant, that shouldn't sort of trigger potential criminal liability if the union official has already made a campaign contribution. Or if the homeowner wants to approach the government to talk about why it took several days to restore power after a storm, that shouldn't potentially trigger criminal liability if the homeowners association has had the representative out to their annual ball game. And the government's only response to that was never really to deny that that would be criminal, but just to say, oh, well, juries won't infer the exchange, and by the way, you know, juries won't convict and we won't prosecute. And the court's answer to that is to say, well, we don't construe criminal statutes based on the government's assurance that they will be restrained in the prosecutions they choose to bring. The other example the court might have given but didn't was just garden variety campaign fundraisers. You pay $100, you make a $100 campaign contribution, and in return, you get a picture with the governor as part of an event at the executive mansion, or you pay $10,000 to the president's political action fund, and in return, you get a night in the Lincoln bedroom. Things of that nature, where the exchange of the quid for the quo is totally explicit and completely routine and part of how, for better or worse, politics is routinely done. The government's theory here would have criminalized all of that, and the court says no, that's very expansive. It raises First Amendment concerns along the lines of Citizens United. They didn't cite that case, but that's what they have in mind. And it raises federalism concerns to the extent you would have the national government dictating a very aggressive code of good government for states and municipalities. That's all I have on McDonnell. So let me stop there and throw it open.
All right. Well, our floor is actually still open for questions from before, so we are not going to hear another prompt this time. But I will give it to you in person. Hit star and the pound key. We have two people in the queue already. And if you want to join after them, please hit star and the pound key to ask a question about McDonnell.
This is Don Santarelli making an observation in the form of a question. Do you think that Breyer, who was vocal at the hearing, at the argument on his belief that this looked like regular, ordinary political conduct, given the fact that he had been chief counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee under Senator Ted Kennedy, and also his counselor in his office, had a persuasive effect on his colleagues who often give the government a great deal of leeway?
So I'm pretty sure that Justice Breyer's experience in the political arena informed his views and explained some of the adamance with which he was recoiling against the government's theory. I don't think it was necessary in a case like this. I mean, the court was unanimous. Many other members of the court have had experience in the political arena in one form or another. Justice Thomas, the Chief Justice, Justice Alito all served in the executive branch, among others. If you look at the amicus briefs in this case, there was a huge outpouring of support for Governor McDonnell from vast swaths of the political establishment, former White House counsels, former AGs, former officials, all of whom made the point that the government's theory would criminalize ordinary politics, and that support completely cut across party lines. It was evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, so there was no case really, even though McDonnell was a Republican governor, there was no hint of any political or ideological skew, because Democrats as well as Republicans recognized that this is a threat to things that just about every politician does just about every day.
It's significant that the chief from the bench recognized the importance of these Amici.
Yes, and in his opinion as well.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, we do have one more question on the line. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star and then the pound key. We'll go to that next question.
It's David Emerson with the in Berkeley chapter of the Federalist Society. I hope this question doesn't run too far astray, but perhaps you can illuminate us if you know a little bit more on the backstory here about why this particular prosecution was brought against this individual, and in particular, why the state level ethics rules. I mean, generally there are codes of ethics which are backed up by a statute which prohibit public officials from taking substantial gifts. And as I understand it here, the amount in issue was over $170,000.
Right.
And it involved items which would not ordinarily be considered just gratuities, Rolex, Louis Vuitton, high-end fashion garments. So I guess the question is why is the government bringing in this prosecution, a fairly difficult prosecution, when it seems like a much easier way to go at this is just to enforce the already existing rules on limitations of gifts?
Well, the short answer to that is that the federal gift rules apply only to federal officials, and the particular gifts accepted by Governor McDonald were perfectly lawful under Virginia gift rules when they were accepted. So any federal official who took gifts of that magnitude under these circumstances would be prosecutable under federal gift rules, but that option was not available to the prosecutors here. And indeed, that was one of the federalism arguments made against the prosecution, which is that it's up to the Commonwealth of Virginia in the course of setting up and structuring its own government institutions to define what sorts of gifts and other interactions between their public officials and their constituents should be legally prohibited. In terms of the point about why the government chose this case as opposed to others, I'll just add the danger, of course, with a theory that covers everything that all officials do, with the escape hatch of only the government saying, trust us, we won't bring crazy prosecutions. We'll go after the Rolex as opposed to the lunch, is that gives federal prosecutors virtually unbounded discretion to pick and choose whom they want to go after. And one can very easily imagine that power being abused.
Okay, we do have one more question on the line, so we'll take that caller now.
Hi, Michael Nowacki, member of the Federalist chapter of Connecticut. And if I understood you correctly, and not having read the decision yet, that the Supreme Court indicated that certain matters would be remanded, and understanding that the decision came out today, would you speculate at all about whether or not you believe that the federal government will continue to pursue a course of action on a remand?
Since we are the governor's counsel in those proceedings, I think I should probably defer on that.
Not surprising. Thank you.
All right. Well, seeing no questions on the line right now, I know we had a few thoughts on Justice Scalia and a few other comments on the term.
Yeah, it seems like any event at the end of this term, it's hard to wrap up without mentioning Justice Scalia. Obviously, this term, the defining event of this term is the loss of this great, great justice who completely changed the way we think about text, about judging, about law. The court doesn't always, by any means, follow his judicial philosophy, as the abortion decision today reflects. But they do all now talk his language. And everyone now at least claims, every judge now claims to be the proverbial umpire just calling balls and strikes, which was Scalia's view of the world and was not the view of judging that had prevailed in eras before him. His loss obviously impacted a couple of major cases from the term. The challenge to Obama's immigration policies and the First Amendment challenge to compulsory union dues for public sector unions were both 4-4, affirmed by an equally divided court, where probably significant precedents moving things in the right direction would have been made had Scalia been around to cast a deciding vote. And then obviously going forward, we're on the cusp of potentially a cataclysmic, once-in-a-generation type change. I've been practicing law since about 1992, and over the course of those two decades, the left has had 4 solid votes for pretty much anything they want to do, block votes. For many years, it was Ginsburg, Breyer, Souter, and Stevens, and now it's Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. With Ginsburg, by the way, openly boasting about this after the gay marriage and other victories last year, they're on the cusp of getting a 5th vote, producing for the first time in my professional lifetime and the first time probably since 1968 or 1971, depending on how you count, a majority liberal court. And by that, you know, people can debate how liberal justices like Kennedy and O'Connor may or may not be. This isn't anything like that. This is a majority liberal court. And that will be something that we haven't seen for a generation.
If I could add to that, the contrast with Merrick Garland could not be any starker. If Merrick Garland were there right now instead of an empty seat, and had he replaced Justice Scalia's seat, he would not have differed or broken from the left on any of the major decisions that have come down in the last month and a half, any of them. There's not a single one, whether it be immigration or now on abortion, that he would have switched, or racial preferences. He would have sided with the liberal bloc to the left of Kennedy, probably, and to the left of Breyer, too. His record is fairly clear in terms of his view of the Constitution, and that just goes to show that the loss of Scalia has been terrible, but also keep in mind that even the people that are being floated around as the potential replacements, we already know would move the court to the hard left and would cause tremendous harm to the Constitution.
Well, thank you both for joining us on the call today. I want to make sure that everyone on the line knows we have a call scheduled for tomorrow that I hope will strike a bit more of an optimistic tone. This Friday will be the 25th anniversary of Justice Thomas's nomination to the court. And before everyone runs off to vacation, we're going to get some people together on a teleforum tomorrow afternoon to reflect on Justice Thomas and his career, including Greg Katsas, and additionally Carrie Severino, John Yoo, and Boyden Gray. That'll be at 4 p.m. tomorrow. We hope to hear from a lot of you again then. Thank you for dialing in today. And with that, we are adjourned. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.